This is an IEEE Computer Society podcast. I'm David Alan Greer, and this is The Known World. I've been intrigued the last couple of weeks with computer systems that give us advice, that make suggestions or recommendations, or somehow try to discern the thoughts and intents of our heart. As always, these thoughts led me to go probing through the journals, build up a stack of papers, well, at least megabytes of papers, and start thinking about what these things do in our lives. I did not really grasp that this was a common concept in information processing until I was standing in the lunchroom of the Computer Society, and I saw, stashed in a corner, a little box with a slot on top of it that was locked shut and probably hadn't been opened in days. From that, I get today's podcast, which is entitled The Honest Give and Take. The email quickly became a constant nag, a dark angel visitant to remind me of my wrongs. Each time it asked me if I would evaluate my recent automobile purchase at Mr. Tony Pro's Auto Mall. Each time I replied with a flick of the delete key. I was in no mood to give Mr. Pro any information that might strengthen his hold on me. Under the best of circumstances, the negotiations over a new car are fraught with inequalities and offer all the advantages to the seller. The sticker price is a fiction. The invoice is no closer to the truth, as regional offices pay incentives on each new car sold to better control the flow of products from factory to market. Every bit of information about automotive preferences or driving habits gives a chit of power to the dealer. Often the customer has no greater power than to bluff and bluster, both of which were factors in my negotiations, I must concede. However, while most customers buy a car only once every few years, or in my case, 14 years, the seller has the dominant position, having ample experience in offering a ready defense that sports a strong handshake, a firm smile, and a protest that he's doing all that he can for you. So when the honest give and take was done and the new car was parked in front of my house, I was really in no mood to give Mr. Pro any more information than was necessary. Although he could protest with all his might that he was merely trying to serve me better, I nevertheless harbored that fear that he was trying to gain the upper hand in a future market transaction. Information technology has not only expanded the scale and scope of global markets, it has also provided the means for probing the meaning of every give and take, for determining the bargain was valid and if the result was valuable. Although they're often treated as if they were the same thing, validity and value are very different concepts. Valid activities are those that are done well, that follow basic principles, that demonstrate the truth of the underlying concepts. Valuable activities are those that are important. They expand the field, find applications to other disciplines, or generate a flow of money from satisfied customers. As engineers, we tend to use experts to determine validity and markets to assign value. Experts review new ideas, test their underlying assumptions, analyze how they were produced. If the results of this effort meet our standards, the experts declare the idea valid. Things can change. The field can evolve. However, as far as the experts can determine, the new idea is a valid addition to the body of knowledge. In assigning value, markets look beyond validity. An idea can be clever, can be completely valid, and represent a substantial intellectual achievement, but still have no value whatsoever. Value need not be measured in terms of profits a concept can produce in the public market or the numbers of workers its production can employ. Yet, markets are influenced by human factors that can temporarily mask value. One party can completely mislead the other into assigning an inflated value to a product. Those who work in the marketplace, such as those who offer automobiles for sale, need to protect their decisions by controlling the flow of information with a paired set of marketing tools, the suggestion system and the recommendation systems. Suggestion systems search for valuable ideas from customers or employees. Recommendation systems present ideas with the intent that customers or employees will find value in them. Both have long histories that could probably be traced with little difficulty to transactions on the Silk Road. However, both have been the object of careful analytic study and engineering practice. They show how systematically we are trying to extract information or create ideas. Suggestion systems are processes that solicit feedback from customers or employees. They're characterized by the familiar, though commonly mocked, suggestion box, usually a container with a slot in its top that accepts slips of paper offering new ideas. With the rise of the modern factory, suggestion systems acquired the trappings of an engineering discipline. They had a theory of operations, a set of best practices, and a professional society. The National Association of Suggestion Systems, or NASS, which was located in downtown Chicago. By the middle of the 20th century, the directors of NASS felt their technology had become crucial to modern industrial management. Having once and for all demonstrated its undeniable worth, they explained, the suggestion system is here to stay, to flourish and thrive and add its full fair quota to the steady onward march of American progress through the years. The standard model for suggestion systems was fairly straightforward. A suggestion box collected ideas from customers or workers. These ideas were sorted by a suggestion clerk who took them to the appropriate managers for validation. These managers validated the ideas. That is, they determined if the suggestions were based on workable ideas, and then they tried to estimate the amount of money that might be saved or earned from each. From this review, the validated suggestions moved to the senior manager or operations committee, whatever it was, who determined the value of each suggestion by looking at the potential incomes or savings in the context of the entire company. They selected the most valuable suggestions for implementation and rewarded the individuals who had put their ideas into this box. Despite its confidence in suggestion systems, NASS was forced to admit that such systems often failed to produce any value for the company. These systems were often expensive to operate and often met resistance from managers and engineers. World War II produced the one brief period when suggestion systems were effective. It was no ordinary time, of course. Many managers were open to the suggestions of outsiders as they were actually new in leadership roles themselves and had no stake in existing production or operational systems. All felt the urgency of the war. Many, if not most, had relatives or neighbors or friends in the combat. By the middle of the war, all production plants were required to provide machinery whereby each man may submit ideas and suggestions for doing the job better. This requirement came with a promise that these systems would tap a vast new reservoir of ideas, welding our productive genius into a united effort for victory. Yet, suggestion systems died a quick and very public death after the war. NASS declared that nearly 95% of all attempts to operate suggestion systems were unsuccessful. Although the organization continued operations for about a decade, it too then disappeared. By this point, suggestion systems had become objects of public ridicule. Cartoons showed suggestion boxes sitting over trash cans, shredders, toilets. The Computer Society's suggestion box currently sits locked in a lunchroom shelf. No one knows where the key might be or what might be in the box. The internet has considerably simplified the process of soliciting and organizing suggestions. Questionnaires can be sent by mail and collated into a central database. Ideas can be sent to managers for required validations. The news of a successful idea can be spread to entire workforces or customer populations. Modern technology has turned the suggestion system into the recommendation system as well, the software that gathers data on customers and identify products that each might find valuable. Recommendation systems, sometimes known as collaborative filtering systems, have proven more valuable than their progenitors. Most large internet retailers have embraced such systems. It's unusual to purchase items without being told what others have bought and what offerings go well with our suggestions or what new products might be of interest to us. One major retailer, Netflix, even sponsored a contest to develop a new recommendation algorithm and, in 2009, rewarded an approach that identified a substantial improvement over the prior state of the art. Recommendation systems have succeeded where suggestion systems did not for a pair of very fundamental reasons. First, they address the problems of mass consumption, which are often simpler to grasp and easier to manipulate than the problems of mass production or mass distribution, which were the common focus of suggestion systems. Second, they exploit one of the fundamental strengths of information processing, the ability to record what we actually do rather than the ideas we propose. According to a recent survey of the technology, most recommendation systems utilize four types of data. Only the first, rating data, comes from the sort of questionnaires the auto dealership asked me to complete. The remainder is data that describes us, that is demographic data, or data that describes our actions in the marketplace, such as behavioral or transactional data. It's one thing to provide misleading responses on a questionnaire, as it only means that we're lying to others. It's quite something else to engage in misleading market behavior, as such actions mean that we are lying to ourselves. For the questions from Mr. Tony Pro's business, I provided the most useless of lies. I scrolled through the form and checked that neutral rating of 4 for each step on the query, which asked me to put a number between 1 and 7, with 1 being low and 7 being high, in terms of my satisfaction with each product or service. However, he ultimately turned the tables on me by capturing a little bit of my identity. After completing the questionnaire, his system began to bombard me with notices to have my new car checked by his skillful and ever-ready mechanics. The notices ranged from enticing to threatening, from promising new features for the car to threatening to void the warranty should I drive far more than the engineering specifications recommended. One day I received a notice that I'd get a free tune-up if I took the car to the shop in the middle of the week. It was a little hook that deftly hid the great truth that there's nothing offered for free in this world that doesn't require payment at some future date. After delivering my car to the dealership, I found a chair in the corner of the showroom where I began to work on some research on my laptop. After 20 or 30 minutes, an employee asked me if I'd like to use the wireless connection. Grateful for the opportunity, I accepted his offer and then asked him about his job at the dealership. I indicated that I had worked for the auto industry during my college years and was interested in how the work might have changed. "I'm the data mechanic," my new friend replied. "Data mechanic?" I asked. "Does that mean you manage the computers and the networks in the office?" "Yes," he responded, "and also the diagnostic and data collection systems in the shop." A moment passed before I realized what he had told me. My car was at that moment sitting in a mechanic stall, freely volunteering my habits as an owner and driver. It couldn't quite reveal every detail about every trip, but it could download information about the number of miles I had driven, the range of my travels, the way I operated the car. Perhaps I hit the brakes too hard. Maybe I accelerated too fast from a stop position. Most likely I dawdled on the freeway, forcing others into a line behind me. All of this information, every little bit, was being relayed to the employees of Mr. Tony Pro. Well, after this first visit, the emails from Mr. Pro changed their tone. Where they once suggested I might be driving the car too much between visits, they now touted the value of maintaining a low-mileage vehicle. He had clearly learned something from my car. He knew I lived in the city, rarely drove during the week. The information that I had so carefully avoided providing to him in the questionnaire or during an exchange with his employees had been captured from my car's memory and now found a home in Mr. Pro's records. He gained one more chip that day in the economic give and take. You have been listening to The Known World. This podcast was based on an essay that was published in the November 2011 issue of Computer, which is a publication of the Computer Society. More about Computer and the Computer Society can be found at www.computer.org. More about this podcast can be found at www.computer.org/theknownworld. All one word for the last one. Other Computer Society podcasts can be found at www.computer.org/podcasts. And if you have any comments, we would love to hear them. You can send those comments to podcasts@computer.org. You can also contact me directly at Greer, G-R-I-E-R, at computer.org. The music for this podcast came from the Music Alley PodSafe Network, and you can find it at musicalley.com. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.